Hello, my name is Andy Bombeck, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program, or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the May 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with an article I didn't finish last week, which is an interview with the famous record producer, Lenny Warnicker. And then Mojo's Essential Guide to Record Store Day 2025. And the Doobie Brothers Spark Up Album Number 16. And a classic album review of one of my favorites, Pearl Jam's Verses. And I'm going to start off with the Mojo interview that I didn't finish last week, titled, It's One of the Last Great Record Men, the Artist A&R in the Golden Age of Warner Brothers and Beyond. Counselor to Prince, Van, Randy, Elliott Smith, and more, shares his wisdom, producing is hard, says Lenny Warnicker. Along with Russ Tittleman, you made some really evocative records in the 70s, particularly Newman's Sail Away and Good Old Boys. Your cinematic rooting is interesting because your work always had that quality. You can almost see the music as much as hear it. In sessions, whenever we would talk about an approach, it was always, what does this track look like? Even today, if I'm in the studio, the first thing I ask is, what's the song look like? Did that philosophy develop into the Warner's house style, the so-called Burbank sound? To this day, when people mention the Burbank sound, I don't know what the fuck they're talking about. It's funny. In the late 80s, we signed Elvis Costello after he left Columbia. I don't know if you know Elvis. He talks a lot. But what comes out of his mouth is fascinating. We had a dinner, and he was talking about how he loved the idea of being on Warner's. He was very well-versed in the history of the company, and he said he wanted to make a Burbank sound record. And I had to tell him, Elvis, I really don't know what that means. Maybe it's that we didn't have a single identifiable sound. Russ and I used to talk about it because he had worked with Phil Spector. Early on, I reached the conclusion that as great as Phil was, Lieber and Stoller were better. One of the reasons was they didn't have a sound. They were just trying different things. If there is a Burbank sound, maybe it's just about changing environments within a record and not staying the same. There was always a conscious effort to shift gears, sometimes in a dramatic way, sometimes in a subtle way. You were made head of Warner's A&R department in the early 70s. You went on to assemble what's considered the greatest A&R team ever, bringing in musicians and producers like Tittleman, Nitschke, John Cale, Ted Templeman, Gary Katz, Tommy LaPuma. Well, I figured if you have A&R people who are creative, who can go in and make records, then good things are going to happen. Our A&R meetings were wonderful because we didn't talk about shit. We just shared our war stories, and we all had them. I remember one meeting in particular. Ted Templeman was a half hour late. Ted was always soft-spoken, but this was a gruff Ted, who'd clearly been up all night, working on this record with Mike McDonald. Ted said, "This song's got a weird shape, and I don't know what to do anymore. Will you guys listen to it and see if there's anything to it?" It was the Doobie Brothers' What a Fool Believes, which ended up being a number one hit and a Grammy song and record of the year. When the track finished, the whole room got up and applauded. If you could just see Ted collapse in relief, it was unbelievable. But without that meeting, who knows? That was the atmosphere we tried to foster. And here's a little bit of that song by the Doobie Brothers, What a Fool Believes. You continued to produce hits for Gordon Lightfoot, James Taylor, and Ricky Lee Jones, among others. By the end of the 70s, you moved away from the studio. Why? Producing is hard. For me, the up moments didn't happen enough, and the down moments happened too much. And then there was the boredom. Often you were there just waiting for something to click. I don't know if we had clocks in the studio, but I remember thinking I was always looking at the clock. That was the beginning of the end for me as a producer. In 1982, Mo Osteen made you president of Warner Brothers at a particularly difficult time. The industry was in a massive slump, and you had to jettison several long-time artists, including Van Morrison and Bonnie Raitt. Was that a tough transition? I had a very difficult time, literally the first A&R meeting that I'm in as president. We had to drop several artists. Our department hated doing that because you were admitting that you made a mistake. In my case, I didn't like to drop them because they were friends, and I didn't have the heart. I was feeble. But us dropping Van Morrison was bullshit. He basically had an offer from someone else, PolyGram, I think. It was a big offer, and there was no way we were going to match it for a couple of reasons. Not because we didn't believe in him, we knew how good he was. So we said, we'll give him his freedom, let him go get a better deal. Of the massive talents that came through Warner Brothers, Prince would presumably be in the top tier. Well, the first thing I heard from Prince was a cassette of 8 or 9 songs, which eventually made up most of his debut album. I couldn't believe it. Because in those days, the only one that could really pull that off, meaning playing everything, was Stevie Wonder. And in comes this kid, and he's done it. I remember we took him in the studio just to see what he was doing. I was uptight about it because I didn't want him to think he was auditioning, because he really wasn't. So we're in the studio, and he puts down drums, then an acoustic guitar, and whatever else. Once it started to come together, it was like, enough. You don't need to do this. I don't want to waste your time. We were so taken by his talent. And the first indication that something was up with him was his response, which was, no, I've got to finish. I've got to get the bass part on. He was adamant about it. Prince was sitting on the floor, getting ready to do the bass overdubs, and there was a little break, and I wanted to talk to the engineer. So I had to walk across this cramped little studio floor. I figured if I have to step over or around Prince, I better have something to say. I don't remember what I said, probably, this sounds amazing. But he looked at me and he said, don't make me black. Meaning, don't market me that way. Not that we would have, but he was really saying, I'm competing against Fleetwood Mac, Eric Clapton, the biggest people all across the board. That encapsulated his ambition and his vision. Even as an 18 or 19-year-old, his ambition was beyond anything. Speaking of mercurial geniuses, you were involved in Brian Wilson's 1988 comeback album. Was that a tricky record to make, given he was still in the clutches of his psychiatrist, Eugene Landy? I hate to say this, but Landy was the worst person I ever met. Landy came in with the idea that everybody thought he was a charlatan, which was true and worse. That was the only time I felt like a politician, because I showed him an enormous amount of respect just to get him out of the way. It was also hard because of Landy's so-called surf Nazis, these young, blonde-haired, tough guys who were watching Brian all the time. I did co-produce the track Rio Grande on that album. That's what I thought Brian should be doing, these little mini symphonies in the vein of Smile. He was going in the right direction, but it was the height of all the craziness. So it was sort of a missed opportunity. There's a little bit of that song, Rio Grande, by Brian Wilson. '90s, you and Mo Osteen left Warner Brothers to launch DreamWorks Records. Of all the artists you signed, did Elliott Smith seem like the one destined for greatness? It was absolutely clear that he was special. He was someone who was always pushing himself. The first meeting I had with him, he was very shy, and he had an orchestration book with him. Because of my experience with Randy and Van Dyke, I think he knew I'd understand. So he said, I want to orchestrate my next record. I thought, fantastic, go for it. What I didn't know was just how enormous his musical instincts and his musicality in general was. That's why his suicide in 2003 was so sad. There's no telling where he would be now. At DreamWorks, you tried to recapture what you'd had at Warner Brothers. Why do you think it didn't quite work out ultimately? Well, it was a combination of things. There was an amount of money that was being spent at a time when it probably shouldn't have been, and our predictions about sales were always off. I mean, way off. The math of the music business was changing because it was the era of Napster and streaming was right around the corner. It was the start of a whole different world. Over the last decade or so, you've returned to Warner Music in an emeritus role, and you have executive produced records by Dwight Yoakam, Jenny Lewis, and Gary Clark Jr., as well as co-producing Randy Newman's last album, Dark Matter, with Mitchell Froom. On Randy's record, I just came in and gave my 2 cents, and all of a sudden, I'm co-producing. I told Mitchell, you don't need me. You know what you're doing. But it's fun to give him and Randy a little push. Hopefully, if Randy ever gets to the point of making another record, I'll be there. If I'm alive, I'll be there. Unlike a lot of record executives, you don't seem particularly concerned about burnishing your legacy. You haven't written the usual self-aggrandizing memoir or put yourself out there publicly that much despite all your achievements. I don't like it. I don't like how it looks or smells or anything. It's a disease in a way, worrying about what people are going to say about you, especially after you're gone. It feels like enough people know about what I was part of. I don't need the whole world to know. Besides, if anyone's really interested, it's all there in the music and the records we made. All right, here's a little side article, Burbank Statements, Three Key Warnaker Productions by His Nibs. Baroque and Roll, Van Dyke Parks, Song Cycle. Van Dyke was incredibly ambitious musically, and I learned a lot from him. My name is on that record as producer, but spending those 8 months working on it was mostly me staying out of the way and discovering the importance of that when you're dealing with somebody as talented as Van Dyke. Regardless of where it ended up commercially, it's still a record I really cherish. And here's a song off the Van Dyke's Park album, Song Cycle, and the name of this song is Vine Street. And another key Warnaker production would be Ricky Lee Jones's album titled Ricky Lee Jones. When we made the first record with Ricky, she was coming out of nowhere, but clearly gifted, really, somebody who had it all. She could be incredibly demanding and sometimes over the top, but she was dealing with all these male musicians in the studio. If she had something to say, she'd say it because she had a real sound in mind. Those are the kinds of artists you want to work with. Here's one song off that album you're probably familiar with. Chuck E's In Love by Ricky Lee Jones. Warnaker production, Randy Newman's Dark Matter. My friendship with Randy is one thing, but as an artist, the thing I've always admired is his consistency and the fact that he's still going. In many ways, Dark Matter is one of his best. Randy's very serious about what he does. He's probably been conflicted at times just because he knows that his inclinations are difficult for the masses to accept. But he never sells out. He just can't. It's not in him. And here's one song off that album, Randy Newman's Dark Matter. This song is titled The Great Debate.
Durham, North Carolina, the heart of the research triangle. We've come to this particular place tonight because we've got to look at things from every angle. We need some answers to some complicated questions if we're going to get it right. To that end, we have here gathered some of the most expensive scientists in the world, eminent scientists, that is. We got biologists, biometrists, we got a quantum mechanic, an astrophysician, we got a cosmologist, a cosmetician, we got an astronaut, we got an astro boy. We got pea doctors, she doctors, knee doctors, tree doctors, we got a lumberjack and a life coach. On the other side, we have the true believers. We got the Baptists, the Methodists, the Presbyterians. Episcopalians are here, past the hat. We got the Shakers, the Quakers, the anti-inoculators, the big ball slime. It's Madison time. Six blind boys.
Okay, now I move on to Mojo's Essential Guide to Record Store Day 2025. It's been a regular fixture on the vinyl aficionados calendar since 2008, celebrating the grassroots record shop and the limited edition joys to be found within. This April 12th, Record Store Day, promises to be no exception, with more than 400 exclusive releases to choose from. As ever, there are collisions of familiarity and novelty. Take the newly rediscovered alternative U.S. versions of Public Images LTD first issue, with subtly reworked sleeve art and a unique track list of re-recordings and different mixes. Also new to Wax is Yellow Vinyl 4-track 12-inch EP Power to the People, live at the 1-to-1 concert, New York City, 1972, by John and Yoko, Plastic Ono Band, and Pals. Taken from Lennon's final full solo shows, three of the four songs are previously unreleased. George Harrison's triple, All Things Must Pass, meanwhile, arrives in a retina-shaking zoetrope picture disc pressing. This year, numerous releases illuminate artist early transmissions, making their vinyl debut, Queen's D. Lane Lea Demos Restore from Acetates, the group's five earliest recordings. Another acetate-derived set is Viva Doc Promus, Songs for Elvis, the Demos, which collects recordings sent to the King by the Brill Building Titan on double opaque orange wax. The Soft Machine Turns On 67. Meanwhile, sources the Canterbury Sinisters, pre-debut LP recordings from the archives of Giorgio Glaminski, the Jesus and Mary Chain's primal A and B side comp 45s 84, 85 on splatter vinyl, with their cover of Floyd's rarity, Vegetable Man, looks enticing too. Other collections shed light on major albums development. Strange Days, 1967, a work in progress, collects early pre-overdub mixes of The Doors' second LP. On blue vinyl, mixer Bruce Botnick adds new notes. Thin Lizzy's Jailbreak alternate version replicates the original album using different takes in a remixed sleeve. Curiously, Tweeze, Tweetham Mix, reverse mixes Slint 1989 debut LP on green wax to better reflect bassist Ethan Buckler's original version. The Steve Albini production style ruined our first recording, he protests. Other albums, boistered by intriguing extras, include Screaming Trees, Clairvoyance, remastered with outtakes, and The Fugues, 65 debut, which is augmented with a whole new album of early sessions entitled Were the Fugues. RSD's live album game remains strong. This year, David Bowie's Ready, Set, Go. Live Riverside Studios 03 presents his pioneering Live to Satellite show of 2003 with a poster. Sly and the Family Stones, The First Family, live at Winchester Cathedral, 1967, captures the group in full flight the year before they crossed over. Other Rude Health documents include Yes's Live at the Rainbow, London, England, 12/16/1972, Talking Heads Live on Tour, 78, and the 13th Floor Elevators Live Houston Music Theater, 1967, Moments, The Montreux Years, Volume 1, Cherry Picks, Unreleased Performances by Muddy Waters, Nina Simone, Marianne Faithfull, and more from the celebrated Swiss Bash on Lake Geneva Blue Vinyl. Roger Waters, The Dark Side of the Moon, Redo, Live, documents the only live performances of the reimagined version of the Totemic LP on neon pink vinyl. Keith Richards and the Expensive Winos weigh in with the Red Vinyl Live 3, 10, 22 EP. The three unreleased tracks are topped off by an etched image of Keith on the flip. Nick Mason's Saucerful of Secrets, live version of The Floyd's Echoes, meanwhile, comes on 12-inch and plays from inside out for enhanced sound quality. It also boasts a special etched design on side B. Visual appeal alone accounts for a slew of RSD swag this year. The Cure's The Head on the Door, Phil Pratt's Star Wars dub, and Fleetwood Mac's self-titled 1975 LP make their debuts as picture disc. In the non-black vinyl corner, The Who's 1975 Tommy OST is reimagined in orange and blue. The U.S. version of The Stones' Out of Our Heads comes as a clear 180G pressing, and Lou Reed's Metal Machine Music is reborn in silver metallic and a new sleeve. Blur's The Magic Whip and Supergrass's I Should Coco both get the Zoetrope treatment. The list goes on. Great reggae comps on vinyl from the Soul Jazz label. Czech B-side LPs, Suede, Madness, and Mark Bolan have that covered. Live vintage jazz, there are Miles Davis, Bill Evans, and Charles Mingus records you may be interested in. Singles, how about Tom Waits' Get Behind the Mule, Taylor Swift's White Vinyl Fortnight, or Be Reasonable on 10-inch from pre-Brit Pop Cults, Boy Wonder. We haven't even mentioned Pete Shelley's Yesterday Is Not Here, Radio Sessions 1979 to 1983. But such is the infinite variety of Record Store Day 2025. Better get queuing early on April 12th then. Here's a side article on Record Store Day. Dude, the Dude Awakening? It's Jeff Bridges' RSD release. Jeff Bridges' film career has, of course, taken in such essential movies as The Last Picture Show and The Big Lebowski. But he's also a musician of long standing. See his T-Bone Burnett produced solo LP from 2011 and more, which brings us to one of Record Store Day's 2025's most intriguing releases. His LP, Slow Magic, 77 to 78, collects various vintage Bridges material. Songs are variously informal and in studio, from Beefheart experimental to Beach Boys melodies. Oh, I was thinking about doing another Quaalude, goes the representative. Loopy, Obnoxious. Two songs have vocals by acting legend Burgess Meredith, who narrates multi-part movie for The Mind Kong. For decades, it existed only as an informal cassette comp. Music would keep bubbling up, says Bridges, surely one of the few men in the world who smoked hash with the aforementioned Meredith and James Mason. I built a little studio of my own, and for about 10 or 15 years, I'd meet with this group of friends every Wednesday night, and we would jam. Those loosely structured jam nights, where spontaneity was the rule, were recorded by Bridges' pals Steve Balm. Other tracks were cut at studio sessions with co-producer Ken Lamber. Fast forward 40-odd years, and Bridges' musician pals Kephas Clancia tipped off reissue specialist Light in the Attic about the tape. "He didn't even tell me," laughs Bridges. "They said, 'Hey, let's do an album.' I said, 'You're kidding me, man.' So boom, we made an album of all these ancient tunes." Bridges, who's also toured with his band, The Abiders, living my Beatles dream, he says, concurs with a promotional notion that the LP is a window into the secret musical life of the dude, a.k.a. the bowling Swami hero of the Big Lebowski, possibly his ultimate creation. "Yeah, I am imagining the dude," he says. "The dude had a guitar hanging around. Was he doing something like this?" Put Walter Sobeck-Chat, the dude's friend, playing on John Goodman on bass. Bridges, who's dealt with cancer, COVID, and the California wildfires this decade, wonders if more next-level out-there wild jams may be released. He also subscribes to the RSD philosophy. "I just recently got a new turntable and ordered a bunch of my old faves," he says, Van Morrison, Dylan, The Beatles, and Slow Magic. "It was wonderful to get that spinning on the turntable. Hey, analog is coming back." Now, on to the article about the Doobie Brothers, and this is titled "The Doobie Brothers Spark Up Again with Album 16. In their 70s heyday, the Doobie Brothers would tour the states in the Special Plane and nonstop party in the sky dubbed the Doobie Liner. One memorable aerial occasion saw the harmonizing blue-eyed soul rockers experiencing weightlessness during a parabolic flight, only slightly marred when someone was sick. Now they're back with new LP, Walk This Road. Will they be touring in it on the Doobie Liner, wonders Mojo. Thankfully, no, laughs vocalist Keysman Michael McDonald. Guitarist, vocalist, and co-founder Tom Johnston, writer and singer of hits including Long Train Running and China Grove, avers, "That was a great way to travel, but it burned down." Old ways and new meet on Walk This Road. Though the latter members and co-founder, singer-guitarist Patrick Simmons, have been reunited since 2019, it's McDonald's first full Doobies album since One Step Closer in 1980. "I really felt a strong urge to put our shoulders onto one more record together," says the unmistakable voice of What a Fool Believes and others. The hard touring outfit started work in late 23 at producer John Shank's well-appointed, comfortable studio in the Hollywood Hills, joined by long-serving multi-instrumentalist John McPhee. They followed a pattern established on 2021's Liberté. Writers worked on songs individually with the fast-working Shanks and session players, which were then augmented by the other members. John's a pretty fabulous writer and a tremendous player, says Simmons, whose writing and singing credits include 1975 U.S. number one, Black Water. He inspired us to push ourselves. The album has some of the sounds and styles that we've done in the past. I like that the band has a signature that's recognizable. The title track, a bluey song of unity, co-sung with Mavis Staples, was written with Shanks specifically for the album. But the rest of the material came from the three principals' song stashes. McDonald says he demoed the kind that last a decade ago. It's like, what have I got hiding up back here in the cobwebs of my mind that might work? There's a little bit of the song Walk This Road, the Doobie Brothers' new album, also titled Walk This Road.
Just where to go. Long as we're together, it'll always take us on. What will be, the path will lead us on. We don't have much, but love is all we need. Walk this road.
New Orleans, says Johnson, was rewritten drastically with Shanks in a matter of 2 or 3 hours. I was dancing around the studio, backing singer Charlotte Gibson singing on it was the cherry on top. Kind of a Mary Clayton with the Stones kind of thing. And having Mike on the album changes everything. I think his additions are awesome. With breaks for gigs, recording and mastering was completed in early autumn 2024. Intriguingly, McDonald and Simmons say they're also open to recording in more tried and tested ways. I think we all kind of missed sitting on the floor together and developing tracks in real time and recording them, says McDonald. Then, things would change and evolve. In the old days, you couldn't cut and paste. You had to just do it until you got it, adds Simmons. So we're going to re-examine that way of working and hopefully, you know, maybe make another record. We're still functioning. Everybody's getting along. Songs are still coming, says Johnson. It's a challenge, but it's still fun. Okay, and here's a review of a photo album titled Diamond R&B. Atlantic Records celebrates its 75th birthday with a lavish photo book. On December 31st, 1947, one of music's all-time great labels was born in New York. Before the founders' signatures sealed the deal, the original name, Horizon Records, was crossed out in favor of Atlantic Records. in charge were Turkish diplomat's son, Ahmet Erdogan, and dental student, Herb Abramson. Using money borrowed from Erdogan's dentist, the two music nuts were up and running. Soon, they'd be joined by producers Jerry Wexler and Tom Dowd. And over the decades that followed, the label released prime jazz, R&B, and, after signing a deal with Stax in Memphis, soul. A move into rock and pop in the late 60s, meanwhile, set the scene for success as part of the Warner Records group. Along the way, still vital LPs by Aretha Franklin, Led Zeppelin, John Coltrane, and CSNY landed in the catalog. These momentous years are chronicled in Tengshom's handsome new visual history, 75 Years of Atlantic Records, the compelling of which evidently took a little longer than its creators anticipated. It features shots drawn from the label's archives and the files of photographers, including Jim Marshall, Annie Leibovitz, Anton Korobijin, Lee Freelander, and more. The accompanied images show three Atlantic signings in their pomp: Disco Inferno hitmakers, The Tramps, New Orleans Grizz Man, Dr. John, and Aretha Franklin, who's pictured in Atlantic Studios in New York in 1970 with an array of celebrated collaborators. The book's 461 pages contain much else to feast the eyes. Black and white shots of artists including Laverne Baker, Ray Charles, the Coasters, represent the 40s and 50s. Things continued to shift in the next decade with elder Erdogan brother Neshuai on the team. Atlantic's jazz side is illustrated in the color by the MJQ, Art Blakely, and Charles Mingus, while the decade's explosion of soul is depicted in portraits of Otis Redding, Percy Sledge, and Sam and Dave. One of several illuminating essays, Barney Hotskin's Pop Goes Atlantic, alludes to the in-house chemistry that promoted such sustained creativity. We had this incredible roster of repeating singers and almost no one-hit wonders. Wexler is quoted, "We believed in singers and not just interpreters." In the rock era, the hits kept coming as Sonny and Cher, Dusty Springfield, and the Bee Gees made room for Cream, The Stones, Yes, and AC/DC, as well as Chic and, in the U.S. at least, Roxy Music. The labels still trading, the ethos that got them so far, it seems, is captured in David Ritz's essay, The Soul of Atlantic, when he quotes Ahmet Erdogan, "We founded this company on music we sincerely loved. And we love the music because we could feel its sincerity." And if you're into Led Zeppelin, okay, this is the article, How to Buy Led Zeppelin. Led Zeppelin, to be a rock and not to roll. Is a visionary too strong? Certainly Jimmy Page had vision. In July 1968, when an L.A. palmist told him of imminent life changes, decisions just days before his then bandmates called time on the Yardbirds, the guitarist was already conceptualizing a supergroup who, after a brief spell as the New Yardbirds, would be named Led Zeppelin, as per Keith Moon's suggestion. Singles? Only very rarely. Studio recordings? They self-financed them, creating a bargaining chip when Jerry Wexler signed them to Atlantic. Zeppelin's explosive electric, eclectic music would tap studio techniques Page had gleaned from recording engineers while working as a sessions musician, and U.S. DJs would be encouraged to broadcast the magic one side of vinyl at a time. That way, epics such as Dazed and Confused could cast their spell. Naturally, the lineup was crucial. A golden god on vocals, abet a homeless one who'd been goofing around in blues covers act, Obbs Tweedle, until Page and his manager, Peter Grant, scouted Robert Plant's Primal Wail and Walshall. Plant assured them there was no finer drummer than his Black Country wingman, former Band of Joy bandmate John Botham, while John Paul Jones, a multi-instrumentalist, arranger, trusted session confrere of Jimmy's on the Shirley Bassey, piloted Goldfinger and more, was a shoe-in bassist after his wife, Mo, urged him to feel Page out, his new group. America swooned first. The early live shows were lightning unbolted, even if they opened for Moby Grape to half-empty houses. Then, between 1969 and 1970, four groundbreaking, earth-shaking LPs arrived so thick and fast they didn't have titles, only numbers. By 1973's House of the Holy, Zeppelin had added reggae and taut funk to their lusty riffage and rustic, sometimes Eastern-flavored folk. Plant skirting around James Brown's famed exhortations to take it to the bridge on the lovingly indebted The Crunge. Ultimately, Led Zeppelin were a bit like their airship namesake, too huge, idolocratic, and vulnerable to disaster to stay aloft indefinitely. Each member's mojo was so critical that in 1980, when John Botham died, age 32, at Page's home in Clewer, Windsor, after a marathon vodka binge, a devastated Page, Plant, and Jones instantly disbanded. Through the accruing multi-faced darkness and tragic losses which cast shadow on the band's perilous music might partly explain why Bernard McMahon's thrilling 2025 documentary Becoming Led Zeppelin is an origin story, not an overview. There were eventually moments of healing, too. In 2012, when the group's three surviving members received the Kennedy Center honors from President Obama, and Hart's Ann and Nancy Wilson, John Botham's son Jason, and a gospel choir performed Stairway to Heaven at the gala, Plant in particular was visibly moved. For years, we'd had these carbon copy media cheap shots fired at us, he told this writer in 2014. It was great to see the Wilson sisters and Jason cut through all that. And the number one voted Led Zeppelin album is Physical Graffiti. You say universally acknowledged by the hard rock fraternity as one of the greatest of all times. A tour Burnt Jones had told Peter Grant he wanted to quit and become Winchester Cathedral's choral master. But Zeppelin rallied, and then some back at Headley Grange, upscaling the grandeur. Their double set tour de force has three exemplary epics: Page's magnificent guitar orchestration, 10 years gone; Cashmere, seismic and hulking enough to soundtrack 1998's Godzilla, when Puff Daddy sampled it on Come With Me; and the Jones-led paragon of synth-drone mysticism, in the light. At Happening, A Happening with Stones pianist Ian Stewart, Boogie with Stu, Trampled Underfoot's Funky Clavinet, and Breathless Riffer, the Wonton Song, also shines alongside easeful, feel-personified ballad Down by the Seaside, an audacious undertaking of which Zeppelin were especially and justifiably proud. Here's a little bit of the song Kashmir from Led Zeppelin off their album Physical Graffiti. Now it's time for the classic album review, and this week is one of my favorites, Pearl Jam's Verses. Happy 30th anniversary to Pearl Jam's second studio album, Verses, originally released October 19th, 1993. Pearl Jam's sophomore effort, Verses, 1993, was a record born of conflict. The title alone is an obvious indicator that the band was gunning for something or someone. Lyrically, the album is awash with references to trauma and discord. The opening refrain from Animal, the album's second song, recounts 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 against one. That puts the band at odds with some notion of corporate America. And here's a little bit of that song, Animal, from Pearl Jam. Some of the conflict came from the relentless touring that went into promoting the band's debut album, 10, an endeavor that was no doubt rewarding as the band became one of the biggest acts in U.S. rock music, but equally exhausting as the toll of press junkets, award ceremonies, interviews, music videos, and dealing with obsessive fans were considered the downside to fame. Something was changing in the band's collective mindset. Upon the release of Verses, the band were adamant that they would not play the corporate game of making music videos for MTV to broadcast nonstop, nor would they allow as much press access or interviews. So in some respects, Verses exist as an intriguing point in Pearl Jam's career. The moment in which their trajectory towards self-determination was truly set upon and the mystique that would surround the band in the years to come was first put in place. In fact, this would be the era in which Pearl Jam would stand up to what they perceived as injustice. Bleeding from the embers of Verses, slogging world tours into Vitalogy, and even into No Code, the band would embark on an epic lawsuit against Ticketmaster on grounds that the astronomical service charges were tantamount to extortion for the band's fans. Pearl Jam would tour sports halls and stadiums that Ticketmaster had no jurisdiction over and basically try to undercut the monolith ticket seller. a noble cause for sure, and one they faced alone, yet an undertaking that took them out of the game for a number of years as they tried to find these out-of-the-way venues in all major cities across the U.S. Not like these activities saw much dent in their popularity. A quick look at the numbers will tell us this. Versus has to date sold a staggering 7 million copies in the United States. In its first week of release alone, it racked up 950,378 units sold, making it the fastest-selling album of all time, a record it held on to for 5 years. Six of the album's songs generated top 40 positions in the U.S. modern rock charts, despite only four actual commercial singles being released. The record also received 3 Grammy Award nominations. And this is just the U.S. perspective. The album topped the charts in 8 other countries around the world. Only a few remnants of Tin's soft, warm, and fluid production are found on Verses. The one song that might have sat comfortably on that record is Dissident, maybe At a Push, Daughter. Instead, the record relies on Dave Abriz's belting drums, Mike McCready's face-melting solo riffs, Stone Gossard's chomping rhythm guitar, Jeff Ament's steady bass, and Vedder's squalling and screeching vocals. Prime examples of this are Go, Leash, and Blood, as these songs teeter on the edge of all-out explosion. And here's a little bit of the song Dissident by Pearl Jam off their album Verses.
Him there, ooh, over a night. I wasn't so sure she wanted him to stay. What to say, what to say.
And unfortunately, once again, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I read articles from the June 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to do the cover story, which is Pink Floyd's remixed album, Pink Floyd, when they played at Pompeii in 1971. And the rise and fall of the British show Ready, Steady, Go, and a classic album review of Shake Your Money Maker by the Black Rose. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music saying so long and keep rockin'.